March 13th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar today, five of which are oral. The first case on our calendar today is A18-1358, Lynn Baker Handelman Siegel versus Independent School District number 273. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for argument, followed by 15 minutes of argument for counsel for respondent, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for the appellant. There is a switch on the podium if you need to raise or lower it, and counsel can proceed whenever you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Tom DeVink, attorney for appellant Lynn Siegel. It is the dreaded slip and fall on ice in the winter in Minnesota. However, we bring to the court today a particular set of facts that on the controlling case law of Nichols, Bufkin, and in fact Rosen, a case involving the very same facility, would entitle my client to proceed to trial. On that basis, respectfully request that suggest that the trial court erred in overlooking the following circumstances.
The prior case that you're talking about has different circumstances as well, though. It's not completely on point. Granted, it does entail the same party, same defendant, but the facts are different there, aren't they?
Agreed. Some facts are different, some facts are the same, and the fact that is the same is that it is the same facility. And we have a circumstance where in 2014, this facility was found to fall outside of the statutory recreational immunity. And we'll talk a little bit later about how that's not really an immunity so much as a bit of a heightened standard for the plaintiff here. And so in 2014, this very same building was outside of the protection of the recreational immunity statute. Now in 2018, when the district court hears it, although there's no evidence of any changes in policies or procedures or the function of this facility, it's now safely within.
For additional evidence about whether the facility is being operated as a not-for-profit facility?
The testimony from the defendant here, from the respondent here, is that, in fact, they don't realize a profit. That was affidavit testimony.
So how is that different than being a nonprofit, not operating for a profit?
As we read the prior case law about the function, and let's think about sidewalks, because really I think if we look at the prior case law on this issue, it's Minnesota, there's going to be ice, people are going to fall. I fell putting my garbage out last week, okay? However, when a municipality steps into the shoes of a proprietor, they are performing a different function. And it's more fair to hold that municipality liable. For example, we look at the Bufkin case, a single point of entry. You're charging money for an event. You are held to a different standard.
But it's not as simple as that. The part of the analysis is looking at whether or not the municipality is receiving income to help defray the costs.
And that's being done here.
Right. And if it's done to defray costs, then it's considered a not-for-profit enterprise.
While they didn't realize a profit, I think the case law is less certain, and I think the case law can be...
How is it less certain?
Well, it's...
What way?
Right. Well, as I read the case law, it's you're charging for the event. You're attracting a crowd to the event. The fact that...
So that alone turns it into an entity that's trying to earn a profit. Is what you're saying?
I think it takes it outside. I don't know about that. I think it takes it outside of recreational immunity, which I think is for the playgrounds, the parks. That's a public policy.
So that makes under your analysis, and any entity that charges would become a for-profit center, even if they don't make a profit. And the only reason they're doing it is to help defray the cost for operating the center.
I think that would take it out of recreational immunity, and I think that's how the prior cases should be read, correct?
And that's how you read the Doyle case as well, then? Because that talks about how it says, quote, defray part of the cost of operation is the standard that we look at.
Right, and I think the evidence in this case is not as certain as the evidence in Dahl, in the sense that, yes, the school district came in and said, we don't realize a profit, we've been losing money, we've been losing money for a long time.
They did more than that, though. They had testimony, and they're operating, the reason why they're charging is to help defray the cost of the operation, though.
And I don't think that the inquiry just stops there, though. Yes, of course, you're going to collect money and use it for the cost of your operation, but where would they draw the line? If 1,000 people showed up and paid $100, they wouldn't turn it down. They could realize
True.
A profit. The fact True. That they don't is not necessarily determinative.
But it seems like those two factors, the fact that they have testimony indicating that all they're doing is trying to defray the cost, and then when you look at the numbers, and not just numbers for 1 year, but numbers over several years, they clearly are not making a profit. And these Sure. numbers are defraying the cost, but they're certainly not covering all the costs. When you have those, and the fact that it's a municipality, what more would be needed to show that they're not operating for profit?
Well, this is a publicly funded facility, and they don't have to charge at all for admission, but they choose to.
I understand that, but what additional factors would be needed for them to show that they're not operating for profit?
Well, I think they would not charge for these events and take in revenue from people like my client.
Okay, so any school, any facility, any municipality that charges, it sounds like you're advocating for a rule where if you charge, even if you charge $1 and you show no profit, then you're considered a for-profit entity.
I don't advocate for that rule.
Well, what am I missing though?
Well, let me answer. I advocate for my client.
Here
is a facility with a wide-ranging array of programs and fees, and that's this court's writing in Rosen. How in Rosen is this outside of recreational immunity, and for my client, the exact same facility operated by the same entity is now within recreational immunity. Fairness to my client would dictate that she is given the same benefit as the plaintiff in Rosen. It's the same facility run by the same party. But even if we hold it to recreational immunity, which, as we'll discuss, it's not really an immunity. All we do is apply trespasser liability. My client testified that this is black ice. It's not a visible or known danger.
In Rosen, this court didn't find that the facility was operating for profit. The court remanded because there was a genuine issue of material fact about whether the facility fell within or whether the for-profit exception applied. So it seems to me that that question wasn't decided by this court, whether the facility was operating for profit or not.
Fair. There was no finding of fact by this court, as is often usually the case.
Right.
However,
and
even
here
if
we have substantial evidence affidavits showing that it is operating at a loss. So isn't this case distinguishable in that regard?
I would agree the factual record is different. The district court, I think, properly noted that. It's certainly been noted here this morning. However, even if we look at recreational immunity and we look at the factors to be considered there, because this is a black ice case, it's not a visible danger. And when it's not a visible danger, the trespasser has a cause of action. It proceeds to trial.
But was there any evidence in this record that you can cite us to that the respondent was in any way aware of this condition?
Well, the prior precipitation event was 2 days earlier. They had, in fact, attempted and failed to make the area safe for passage to the entryway. And under the reading of the Nichols case, albeit from 1922, once the ice is left there for this amount of time and it becomes that invisible, if you will, or very hard to see smooth black ice,
I thought they had put a substantial amount of ice melt. Melt on prior.
Sure. I mean, there's no question that the school district had a duty to render the premises safe. That lone entryway from the parking lot on roughly the southwest area to the facility where they were holding the event. There's no question they had the duty. But the evidence is they failed that duty. And Ms. Siegel testifies without contradiction that she slipped on black ice, saw the black ice, and then hours later they did finally, 2 days later, address that slippery condition created by their failure to take care of it sooner. So on these facts, because it's not a visible and known danger, even the trespasser has a cause.
Well, but that's a separate issue, isn't it? You're talking about whether, you know, it almost sounds like you're talking about whether or not it was an open and obvious or a hidden danger, and that's a separate issue from whether or not it was an artificial condition. I thought that's what your argument more was going toward, that it was an artificial condition that had been created.
We argue that as well based on Mr. Diaz's testimony. We argue that as well. But we argue that there is trespasser liability here. So even if we apply recreational immunity, and that's really the key, even if I lose on all those questions that I didn't do so great on 10 minutes ago on recreational immunity, and we apply the trespasser standard, respectfully, my client proceeds to trial because it is not a known and visible danger.
But for your client to win on the trespasser exception, doesn't your client have to show that the possessor, the school district created or maintained the condition under Johnson v. Washington County?
Permitted it to exist, created it in the sense that they did not clear the ice, and therefore, as we read in the Nichols case, over time, yes, sleet and snow when it falls, that's not a cause of action, that's not negligence. But when ice is allowed to remain for an inordinate or unreasonable amount of time, and that would ultimately be for the jury, for an unreasonable amount of time, then the maintaining entity, the maintainer of that property, does become liable because it becomes an unsafe and unknown, hard to see if invisible condition of black ice. And because there had not been precipitation for 2 days, it is only the defendants just missing it, just not getting that spot. And the problem with that is it's the only entrance.
I'm a little confused there because I thought your allegation was that it was an artificial condition created by, for example, somebody spilling some, like a beverage or something. But you're referring to the prior snow and ice or rain, the prior event a couple days ago, and you're saying that this was a result from that and they just missed it?
That's right, and we argue that in page 10 of our brief, citing to the Unzen case. We do argue, respectfully, that there is a suggestion of an artificial condition. Mr. Diaz's testimony at his deposition about this is where people would throw bottles of water, and he writes in his handwriting on one of the notations in evidence to the District Court Exhibit 6, he says, oh yeah, we've had ice spot, and I'm paraphrasing, but people have been disposing of water bottles there, and we've had ice there from people disposing of their water bottles. It's a suggestion of an artificial condition. In this case, in the record, we don't have direct evidence of Ms. Siegel or another witness saying there's a water bottle there and someone threw it there. That would be an artificial condition, but there is a suggestion of an artificial condition here. We argue that in the alternative. But we also argue, relying on Unzen, U-N-Z-E-N, that the condition had been left long enough that the black ice defect is not an obvious condition. We argue it's less obvious even than the, you know, in Unzen it was that rollerblader with the stairs and they weren't even, the nosing of the stairs. I think this is less obvious. Yes.
Well, I want to go to the facts that were submitted.
Sure.
And that's part of this record. And apparently there is a Mr. Vandalinda Lindy that submitted an affidavit that said that he walked the entryways and the sidewalks daily and that he had, in fact, put 110 pounds of ice melt down. And there's nothing in the record that rebuts that. So, I mean, what can you point to in the record that rebuts his contention that he had walked all this?
No dispute with Mr. Vandalinde. I assume that's truthful testimony, but he missed it. He may have put down a million pounds of ice, but he didn't get the ice.
What in the record indicates that he missed it? I mean,
Ms. Siegel's testimony that there was black ice there that I observed that I slipped on, and in fact, we then have a subsequent remedial measure where...
Well, let's put aside the remedial measure, but the fact... Let's go back to Judge Hooten's point is... That's unrebutted testimony that he basically walked the entire area. And this is not the area that this occurred. That was not that was a well-trafficked area. So the unrebutted testimony seems to indicate that the whole place had been cleared of any ice at all after all the ice melt that had been placed down on it.
No, there was ice there. My client slipped on it and fell on it.
No, no, you're missing the point. The unrebutted evidence indicates that the entire place had been salted, okay? So that, in addition to the fact that the ice that had been seen, it didn't have any ripples or anything. So usually when ice is in a place for a while, you start getting those ripples, right? And there's no evidence of that here at all.
There is ridged and ripple ice.
Right.
References in the authorities, but there's also the black ice references in the authorities, which also takes time to develop, as do ridges. Just because the maintaining entity took steps doesn't mean they met their duty. And
what evidence is there in the record to show that, though?
Your Honor, the ice. There's black ice that my client slipped on and fell on, and they had a duty.
There's 2 days where that occurred. Is there any evidence in the record of anybody else observing any other ice within that 2-day period? Anybody else slipping? Any other complaints? Is there anything like that in the record?
There is not, and there does not need to be. There absolutely does not need to be. The fact that no one looked at that area and said there wasn't ice. In fact, the evidence is they looked at that area and put ice melt down on it where my client fell. They didn't ice nothing. They didn't melt nothing. They were addressing the dangerous condition that injured my client.
Right, but I think what we're trying to get to is, where did the ice come from? What's the origin of the ice? Because that will determine to a certain extent which cause of action would apply and what they could be potentially liable under, either whether it's an artificial condition that had been created, or was it something that were they were negligent because it was there and it was had been existing for quite some time.
True, and my client's position is that if it's naturally occurring, the prior precipitation event was so earlier in time that they would have an obligation to remove this within 2 days. And if it's artificial, of course, it comes out of these protections by statute. And my client would proceed. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mark Asman. I represent the Edina Public School District in this litigation. I think I'd like to start with backing up a little bit. And so when we were down before the trial court, we presented undisputed facts, and we asserted two defense theories. One was the mere slipperiness rule, and one was rec immunity. Now, rec immunity has two different components to it. We can talk about that in a minute. But with the mere slipperiness rule, I'm not really hearing from counsel or the court that there's really any dispute that the rule itself applies. We're only really talking about the exceptions being a for-profit aspect or whether there's an artificial condition that exists. So going way back to 1890 in Henkes versus Minneapolis, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided that, look, smooth glare ice that occurs on a public sidewalk where someone slips is simply not a basis to allow a negligence claim to proceed. There's just not enough money in the world, there's not enough resources in the world to expect school districts or cities to clean all that off immediately and perfectly. So there's a bit of a grace permitted. And
could I ask you this? Because I read the brief of the appellant here, and I guess I had understood that the allegation was that someone had left water bottles on the sidewalk and that they were causing spills, and that was his theory of the case.
Sure.
Was this mist black ice theory ever brought before the court?
let's approach that two ways. One, we're talking about really the phantom water bottle, and that's really the best way to. There is no water bottle. All right. There is a notation by a groundskeeper in one of the records that indicates, sometimes in this area, on occasion, we may have found a water bottle on the ground where somebody had emptied it out. But that groundskeeper who wrote that wasn't there on the day of the accident, didn't, of course, then see the scene of the incident, and no testimony, no evidence shows that there was any water bottle anywhere. So basically, this was basically speculation. Well, sometimes stuff happens. We don't know. Occasionally there's a water bottle, but nothing like that happened in this case. There's no evidence of it. Nobody saw anybody with a water bottle. Nobody saw anybody emptying a water bottle. Nobody saw any water bottles. So the whole water bottle is really a red herring to try and create a fact dispute. where there isn't one.
Well, is that really a red herring, though? Because there, let me ask you this. Yes. Is there any dispute that there was ice on the ground?
We don't have any reason to believe that nobody saw the ice but the plaintiff. The only testimony in the case is that plaintiff slipped on glare black ice. And there's no evidence to indicate to the contrary. So we don't.
So that's an undisputed issue of,
correct.
Of material fact.
Correct. But the cases, when you deal with mere slipperiness, if you have glare, smooth, black ice, that fits squarely within the rule. We win, period. The only saving that plaintiff can look to is if one of the exceptions applies, and that is if there's an artificial condition. The only artificial condition that they can come up with is this phantom water bottle that doesn't exist that somebody mentioned. That's a metaphysical doubt that we submit just doesn't exist.
So is your position they win on artificial condition only if it's from a water bottle, but if it was from ice that was left over from 2 days ago when the prior precipitation?
That's a natural condition from the sky like we've seen in Nichols or Henke's, where the court identifies the general rule. Ice that appears from the sky, from clouds or snow, is a natural condition. Even
so, ice from a storm or snow or melting snow is only related to the recreational immunity claim.
No, that's a trespasser issue with rec immunity.
Well, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
In terms of the mere slipperiness exceptions, it's your argument that the black ice would not fall within that exception.
That's correct. The only way the mere slipperiness rule would not apply is if the ice had been left long enough to create ridges, hummocks, depressions, irregularities, and that's the black letter law. Cases like, I believe, Doyle and Rodenwald talk about plaintiffs making arguments like, well, this ice was there a long time. They should have cleaned it up. But those cases reject that theory. Doesn't matter how long the ice is there. What matters is if it's there long enough to create those ridges or irregularities. That wasn't present here.
Well, I think my question to you, though, was the argument made before the district court that the reason that black ice was there was due to the fact that this Mr. Vandelinde
sure.
missed the spot? And missed putting ice melt on there. Was that ever argued?
It wasn't, but that's not a relevant inquiry into whether the mere slipperiness rule applies. He could have missed it all day long, but if it was clear, smooth, black ice, that fits within the mere slipperiness rule, period. And that's because we can't expect public entities to hit everything all the time with complete perfection. We just can't do it. That's what the cases explain, is it would bankrupt communities. And so even if he did miss it, it's legally irrelevant. It has to be a point where it's been there long enough to create a ridge or a hummock in that aspect. And that means in this case that there isn't evidence to support the artificial condition. The other evidence is, the other exception is the for-profit. We've discussed that quite a bit. I think Rosen is always a thorn in the side because it involved the same school district, the same community center, the same slip and fall, the same legal theories being presented by the district. But I think what the concern was in Rosen with the for-profit issue was that there wasn't sufficient evidence submitted by the school district to establish or sufficiently prove that it was not a for-profit adventure. And so there was only a declaration in that case. Well, we observed that, knew about it, and in this case decided to submit not only a declaration but also the spreadsheet information of all the financial data. So we think we learned the lesson we needed to learn in Rosen, and now we're here and we've submitted sufficient information to show, look, it wasn't operated as a profit, and there's testimony as well that the district didn't try to operate it as a profit.
And that was unrebutted?
That's correct, Your Honor, unrebutted. Sorry, Counsel.
I want to go to another question as to whether or not it was argued below, is whether or not the argument was made that this was a hidden defect or whether this was an open and obvious.
Sure. That that's part of the trespasser exception under the rec immunity, and that is not an issue that I recall being addressed by plaintiff in order to, you know, try and invoke the trespasser exception. To the extent it was, there's really no evidence that the condition was hidden. I mean, and I think in Bufkin, the ice was under some snow. The rule still applies. There's no evidence here that the ice was hidden. There's no evidence that it wasn't a condition that was not observable. In fact, when you look at the trespasser exception, the case law provides that the district is entitled to assume that the trespasser, here a plaintiff, is going to be on the alert to observe conditions. And so I don't see any evidence in the record that this was a hidden condition. It was ice on a sidewalk. Plaintiff claims, well, it wasn't well lit. Well, it was lit. It wasn't dark. No one else fell. There's no reports of anyone else falling.
What time of the day did this happen again?
That's unclear from the record. It appears it was sometime around what I'll say the dinner hour, 6 o'clock maybe, on a Saturday, I believe. Some of the records indicate 7:45. Some of the testimony indicate a little earlier than that. So, it was January, so it was probably during, you know, lesser light out, natural light out. But it was lit at that. On those. So we believe that rec immunity applies straight up. It's a recreational facility being owned and operated by the district. The claims arise from that. The only real issue is whether the trespasser exception applies. There's no evidence that we knew about this condition, the district did. There's no evidence that, like I said, that it was hidden. There's no evidence of this. You know.
What about appellant's argument that it was created by the school district because it was the period of time between the snow event and when the appellant fell was 2 days?
That would assume that snow event was the source of the ice. And I don't think there's anything in the record that would support that position. The only other, I think, argument might be this water bottle issue again. But like, how is a litigant supposed to defend against the phantom water bottle that no one can point to, and it just doesn't exist? So that evidence really, under Teske versus Steele County, I believe, is so speculative that it just should be simply excluded. It's not dependable. This case really doesn't present novel issues of law or fact. We've got a standard slip and fall. We've got tried and true black letter concepts of defenses that are applying, that do apply. And the district court did a nice job in analyzing those, and we're asking that the court affirm the district court level. Absent any questions from the court, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
On the black ice issue, I think it's responsive to both Judge Houghton and Judge Reyes's questions. My client did raise the black ice argument in the district court, specifically in addressing the case law from Duluth, the Unzen and Leshinsky, and it goes to the obviousness of the condition when we talk about trespasser liability under the recreational immunity analysis. I wish it was an easier way to say that. But that's where the context in which it came up. I think my brother alluded to that connection, but I wanted to address that directly.
Well, I think the question, though, wasn't about, I mean, I think you've been very clear that there was black ice that you believe caused this. But whether that you argued to the district court that the basis of the liability was the fact that Mr. Vandalindy missed the spot.
In a more general sense.
And that was my question. Is
yeah,
there anything
fair
in
enough.
The, did you argue that before the district court? Because I guess I had not gathered that from your briefing.
The argument was phrased in this way, that my client argues that the defendant permitted the condition to exist for a sufficiently long period of time that liability is fair and should attach. Never argued specifically that Mr. Vandalindy's not very good at salting or melting for ice, because we don't think that's the relevant inquiry. I think it's whether or not the condition, there's evidence in the record suggesting the condition existed for a sufficient period of time to make it fair to put liability, to assess liability potentially to this defendant.
And that goes to the argument that the condition was one that the possessor created or maintained?
Or allowed to exist for a sufficiently long time to render liability fair. The maintainer of the premises isn't just liable for conditions it creates, also conditions that it exists, permits to exist for a sufficiently long period of time when there's a duty to maintain the premises in a safe condition, Your Honor.
Is there any case law that suggests 2 days is a sufficiently long period of time? That seems to be not too, you know, that seems rather short.
On this point, we would rely on the policies and procedures of the school district itself, and that policy handbook is submitted in the record. And in fact, they did try to, or did in their mind, adhere to that policy in terms of how often and when they go out and take action. Our position simply is that whatever steps were taken weren't sufficient on these facts to protect Ms. Siegel from the, or to remove the black ice condition on which
right,
she slipped and
fell. Right, but that, yeah. Regardless of their policy, is there any case law supporting that 2 days is more than enough time that where they should have done something?
There's no case law that I'm aware of that says that,
okay.
That holds that.
And I want to follow up a question I had for opposing counsel. And I mean, because when I was looking at the your arguments under, and I think one of the key issues you raised was under the statute, whether the condition is one that they created or maintained, which is, as I read. But when in your brief, then you in support of that? You cite to the Leshinsky and Unsen cases, and I was confused by that because those go to more the hidden defect, but that seemed inconsistent with the argument on whether or not they created or maintained. Did below to the district court, did you argue that this was a hidden defect, a hidden condition, which created liability versus one that was open and obvious?
Yes. In arguing under Section 335 of the second restatement, the fourth prong of trespasser liability speaks to the maintainer of the land understanding that the trespasser here, Ms. Siegel, under this analysis, would not know of the condition. So it's the argument supported by the Unsen and Leshinsky cases that this is not a plainly visible. The trespasser is not protected if the danger is plainly visible. The trespasser has to just take care. If the condition is not obvious or not, well, I'll read from it. If the condition is not of such a nature that the possessor has reason to believe that the trespasser will not discover it. So that's how the restatement.
So let me ask you this then. I mean, you cite to these cases, but all you talk about is hidden defect and then cite to Leshinsky and then Unsen. How is this argument forfeited? Because I don't see how this argument has been developed in terms of whether this is a hidden defect, how is it a hidden defect, and what facts support that it is considered, it should be considered a hidden defect.
Ms. Siegel testified that she could not see it, that even after she slipped and fell on it, she had to sort of focus and stare and say, oh, there's black ice, but it wasn't plainly visible to her or anyone else based on her testimony.
Okay, but that's not part of the...
Well, your time is up, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory time period.
Thank you.